All right, we're beginning here on the top of Lamed Vav and Aleph by the two dots. The Mishnah says, "Ve'edim chutmim al get mipnei tikkun olam," that the edim sign on the get because of tikkun olam. Mar says, "Mipnei tikkun olam deoraito." What do you mean? This is tikkun olam. That's min haTorah. Interesting enough, Gemara says it's min haTorah, and then quotes a pasuk from Navi. Yeah, the Gemara will do that in places where it believes that it's a fundamental principle, and that the Navi is just recording something that was already in practice. The Navi is not teaching us a new mitzvah. It's not a mitzvah Navi'im. The Navi is just disclosing to us, or a Giloi Milta, about something that was already in place. Dechtiv, v'chatov, b'sefer v'chatom. So this is what we've seen before, that the Gemara uses the story with Yirmiyahu as a paradigm for shtarot. As part of that, you see, write the sefer v'chatom, and sign on it, implying that the signatories to a document are an integral part of the document. Amar Rabba lotzricha the Rabbi Elazar. So only need it for Rabbi Elazar. Damar edim misire karti, because he's of the belief that edim misire are karti. Takinu Rabbanan edim chatima bipnei tikkun olam. So the tikkun olam is according to Rabbi Elazar, who does not require chatimata edim in the document in order for the document to be a valid document d'oraita. Rather, it's a tikkun olam because edim misire karti, the edim that are witness to the transference of the document between the parties are the edim who make it into a valid document. So we have mipnei tikkun olam that they actually sign on the document itself. The zimni demaiti sade, because sometimes the witnesses die when you have edim misira, and then we have no way to validate or verify the document once the edim pass away. So if we have their signatures, we can verify or validate the document even without them present, because we can check it against other signatures that we have of theirs, or we can have other witnesses come and testify to the fact that it is their signature. But if all you have is edim misira, once they pass away, then we have no way to verify the information. Inami, zimnen dazle de medina tayam. Or the same problem, which is if they travel overseas and they're not present, if we don't have them sign, somebody signing on the document, then we have no evidence that we can use in lieu of these edim misira, and they become too pivotal, in a sense, in the validation of this document. Now here it comes back to, if you remember, the machloket that we saw earlier in the Masechta between the Rif and the Balei HaTosafot. According to the Rif and all the Rishonim that follow in the Derech HaRif, that Rabbi Elazar believes that if you did sign on the document, then that makes it into a valid document, and edei chatima would be karte, and the pasuk in Yirmiyahu, which suggests that one has to sign in order for the document to be valid. Rabbi Elazar subscribes to that and believes that it works as well. If you just signed the document, that would be a valid and good document. And that all that Rabbi Elazar says is that af edei misirei karti, that not only do the signatories make the valid document valid, but so do the edei misira. And then once you've used edei misira, why sign on the document? Because of tikkun olam. So according to him, tikkun olam is only in a case where they used edei misira instead of edei chatima. Then for the Balei HaTosafot, who believe that, Rabbi Elazar believes there's only one way to have a valid document, that's through edei misira, then always the edei chatima are mipnei tikkun olam, because the edei chatima can never make the document into a valid document. So how broad this takana is depends on what you feel Rabbi Elazar's shita is. For the Tosafot, it means any time, because for Rabbi Elazar, there's only one way to have a valid document, that's through edei misira, so it's always tikkun olam. Whereas for the Rif, it depends on what you did first. I mean that if you have it with edei misira, without edei chatima, then midoraita, the get is a good get. Then you deal with the separate issue is that once the Rabbanan instituted something, what does that do or impact on the din doraita? The Prima Godim in his introduction talks about when you have such an institution, the Rabbanan, how does it affect the din doraita? So if the Rabbanan say you need to mitukun olam, have signatories to a document, if you fail to put those signatories on the document, is that just a violation of the din derabanan? Or does that eliminate the get completely, meaning that it's no longer even a get deoraita? We find that by the mitzvah of sukkah, where the rabbanan say certain types of schach are psulim. So if that schach is pasul, but midoraita is good schach, and you sit in such a sukkah, is it a sukkah? Because min haTorah, it's a good sukkah. The rabbanan said it's not a good sukkah. So now, is there a mitzvah of sukkah that you mekayim when you sit in it? Or once the Rabbanan say it's not good schach, they're mafkir your ability to migmikayim the mitzvah midoraita. We find that by also by Kriyat Shema, by Chatzot. If you go over Chatzot with Kriyat Shema, does that mean you're no longer mikayim the mitzvah of Kriyat Shema after Chatzot? Because the Rabbanan said don't do it. Or you're still mikayim the din doraita, but you are violating the restriction midorabanan. So you'd have the same issue here, which is, if you use Eidei Mesira and it's good midoraita, but you fail to have the signatories based on the takana, what does that do in terms of impact on the din doraita of the validity of the get? Now, Rav Yosef Amar, afilu teima de Rabbi Meir. We can even explain this takana in the Mishnah according to the sheet of Rabbi Meir, who says, Eidei Chatim Akarte, Hitkinu she'edim mefashim shmoteyem begitin mipnei tikkun olam. That the takana here is not about the fact that they signed the get, or they signed the document, because that's a fundamental requirement according to Rabbi Meir. Eidei Chatima Karte. That's the way that the get goes into effect, is through the signatories. But how they signed the get has impact, and that's what the takana was about. Kedetanya, Birishona, Yakotev, Ani Ploni, Chatamti Eid. According to this Girsa, they used to write seemingly their first name, and it would say, I, Ruvain, I, Shimon, Eid. And that was it. Then, how do you validate a document with someone's just first name on it? Im tav yado yotzei mimakom acher, kasher. If they could find an alternative document that was signed by the same individual, and that alternative document had been validated by Beit Din, so that was something that already had the stamp of Beit Din on it with his signature, then it would be kasher. Vim lav, pasul. They couldn't find such a match, then it would be pasul. You can understand the difficulty in this, because it would only apply if they signed other documents. But not only if they only signed other documents, it was other documents which had some aspersions cast about them and then were validated in Beit Din. You'd have to find such a match in order to verify or validate the current document, because we have no idea who these Edim are, because they just wrote their first name. Others suggest that the Girsa was that Kotev Chatamti Eid. They just used to sign as an aid, and that means they didn't even put their first name down. They used to draw a picture, they used to write something that indicated it was them, but nothing that made it, that it was definitively them, because there was no name there. So Amar Rabban Gamliel, Takana Gdola Itkinu, Shiyu Mifashim Shmoteyem Begitin Mipnei Tikkun Olam. So that's what Rabban Gamliel did in terms of this Takana, which was that they put in place that they have to specify their names, their name, and their father's name. So now we have something that makes it more unique, or it makes them identifiable, and now we can go and either find these Edim, or find people who know these Edim, because then they could verify for us their handwriting and say, yes, we recognize the signature. Because once you know who it is, it's much easier to get evidence as to whether they are the signatories to this document or not. But with a just first name, or just some sort of sign that isn't so unique, it's very hard to verify or validate such a document. All right, ubi simono though. So from this, it indicates that you have to specify the name of the individual. Whether that means in the first place there was no name, and then later on they instituted that you have to put the name in, or whether the way our Girsa reads, which is they originally only had their first name, and then they added in their full name, Ben so-and-so. And again, if it was not clear, for instance, in cities where both two people had the same name, then they would go to a third generation, or if they were a Kohen or a Levi, or some other distinguishing feature that they would try to use to identify the individual. So that would be the possibility, but it seems from this that you can't use some sort of siman, like a stamp or something that was unique to the individual. Va, Rav Tzier Kura. Rav used to, instead of signing his name, draw a fish. For Rabbi Chanina, Tzier Charuta. And Rav Chanina used to draw a palm branch or a palm tree. Rav Chista Samuch. Rav Chista used to draw a samach, probably for his name Chista. Rav Hoshaya Ayin, probably because, again, Ayin inside of his name. Rabba Bar Ravuna Tzier Makuta, that he drew, Rashi says over here, sails. Makuta was sails. The Rashbam in other places says that the Makuta is the mast of the ship. But either way, it's some picture about a boat or a sail or a ship. Something to do with that. So you see here that all these Amoraim were not signing their names, that they were using basically their stamp, right? Some sort of identifying picture that they used to draw that was their signature. I mean, not only was it the picture, but it was the way they drew the picture that was something unique to them. So how can they use these simanim and not put their names down? It says, Shaini Rabbonon Dibikiin Simanayu. Rabbonon are different because they are well known. Their siman or their sign is well known. similar to what goes on today with kashrut, meaning that the symbols that are used for the kashrut, so that's unique, whether it's the OU, the OK, COR, all the different countries that use a coding of some sort to indicate that this is under the supervision of a certain kashrut organization, that sign is unique to them and is associated with them and cannot be copied, and therefore it's an identifying mark that tells you that this is kasher. So to over here, they use some sort of unique siman that was well known to other people, and therefore when they signed with it, everybody knew that that was their signature. But the Gemara asks an interesting question, mikara b'may afkinu. That works well once they become well known. Before they came well known, how do people identify their signatures? How could Rav start with the fish if nobody knew that that was his signature up front? You're right. Once he became famous, and once everybody knew him, so everybody knew the fish was associated with Rav. But before that point, to get to that point, how did that happen? So Gemara says, b'diske. They threw documents. As Rashi says, over b'diske, which is shtarei shelot v'tshuvot u'shlomot. That they were writing shelot v'tshuvot. People were writing them halachic questions, and they were responding with regards to those halachic questions, or they were sending back and forth letters. Here he calls them shlomot, but just social letters between the parties. So their symbol gets famous or spread by the fact that they're corresponding with that symbol. So it's not an any shtar, which is something that needs a tokef and baked in, or that needs to be validated in any way. So through other channels, their signature or sign becomes famous. And then once that was the case, then when they signed on proper documents, then already it was well known, their sign, and therefore it was well accepted that that was that individual, and they didn't have to worry about the fact that they're using a siman instead of a proper name. Hillel Itkin Prusbol. Alright, so this makes this Gemara one of the most famous Gemaras in Shas, because over here, Hillel Itkin Prusbol, this Gemara here deals with the issue of Shmitat Ksafim, and a lot of the trappings around Shmitat Ksafim and how Prusbol works, and therefore it has a lot written about it, but also has implications because of that. So we know that Hillel Itkin Prusbol, which is what was found in the Mishnah, what exactly that is, it's not Hotam. We have a Mishnah in Shvi'it, which tells us, Prusbol Enu Mishamet, that a Prusbol is not subject to Shmitat Ksafim. Now again, Prusbol Enu Mishamet is an interesting Lashon to write, because the Prusbol is not necessarily a document of loan, but rather a document that indicates releasing or relinquishing control of the documents to Beit Din, and not the loan itself. And if you look in Rashi, he also changes the subject of the sentence a little bit. But the idea being that once someone has a Prusbol in place, Shmitat Ksafim does not affect their loans. Ze'achad min ha-dvarim, shehitkin Hillel ha-zakein. This is one of the things that Hillel ha-zakein put into practice. Shera'ah et ha'am shimnu m'la'avot ze'edzeh, that they stop lending money to one to the other. Vavru al mashe katu b'torah. And they violate the Nisr Doraita, which says, that maybe it will come out that something untoward will be in your heart, which is that you will see karav shnata shmita, that we're getting close to the shnata shmita, and therefore you're unwilling to lend the money because you know that once the shnata shmita comes, the loan is going to be forgiven. So why would you lend money assuming that it's just going to be forgiven right away? So people were reluctant to lend money because they knew that they weren't going to get their money back anymore. Amad v'itkin Prusbol. So then Hillel put in place Prusbol. V'zehu gufo shel Prusbol. And here is the core language of the Prusbol. Mosrani lachem. And it's clear here that there's something missing from the Girsa, because we quoted this Gemara back on Daf Lamed Bet Amud Bet to explain the shitot of how many dayanim there were. And over there it said, Masrena lechem, ploni uploni dayanim. There were two dayanim mentioned here. Here we only have the word ploni once. You can see in the Masorat HaShatz that he ends in, ploni uploni dayanim, that there were two dayanim, shemakom ploni, in such a place, shekochov sheishli etzel ploni, any outstanding obligations that I have with such an individual, shegvenu kozman sheertzeh, that I can then collect it when I need to, but dayanim chutmim lamata, then the dayanim sign at the bottom, o'aidim, or the witnesses, and that again we saw before, what was the connection or correlation between witnesses and dayanim, that was part of that machloki between Rav Nachman and Rav Sheshet. Umi ika midei midoraita mishamto shvi'it, How could it be possible that min haTorah, the Torah says to you that loans are forgiven in the Shemitah? V'hitkin Hillel, d'lo mishamto. And here along comes Hillel and says, no problem, it's not subject to Shemitah Ksafim anymore. So how does this work that Hillel somehow is circumventing what is otherwise a din d'oraita? The din min haTorah is that if you have a loan outstanding when you get to the Shemitah, it's automatically forgiven. And Hillel over here is all of a sudden creating some sort of vehicle that overrides that. How can you override a din d'oraita? Abaye solves the problem and says, Amar Abaye, b'shvit b'zman hazeh v'rabi hu. It's shvit today, according to Rabbi, to Tanya, Rabbi Omer, v'zeh dvar ha-shmitah. This is the word of the Shemitah, or this is what Shemitah is about, Shamot. So now, there you have Shemitah and Shamot. B'shtei Shemitot, akadu midaber. The pasuk is speaking about two Shemitot, achat Shemitat karka, v'achat Shemitat ksafim. There's some sort of hekesh, a correlation between the Shemitah of the karka and the Shemitah ksafim. B'zman she'ata mishamet karka, ata mishamet ksafim. When Shemitat karka is extant and in practice, then there is Shemitah ksafim. B'zman she'ata mishamet karka, i'ata mishamet ksafim. When there is no Shemitah karka, there is no Shemitah ksafim. All right, now, this has much written about it. Each stage here, there's so much embedded in each stage here, so we're going to take a step back now and just discuss Shemitah ksafim and the prusbo and how it works in these situations. The first thing to understand is that Shemitah ksafim, according to the majority of Rishonim, it's kimat all the Rishonim, happens at the Shnat HaSheva, the end of the seventh year. That means at the completion of the Shemitah year, at that moment, when you walk into Rosh Hashanah of the eighth year, that's when Shemitah Ksafim takes place. The Rosh brings an alternative view, the possibility that Shemitah Ksafim happens at the beginning of the Shemitah year. Now, there are problems with that, and the Rosh deals with that by saying that maybe the completion of that Shemitah, or the Shemitah Ksafim happens at the end of the year, but from the beginning of the Shemitah year, you're no longer allowed to collect on those loans, even though the loans are only forgiven at the end of the Shemitah year. Because of that, there are some Bali Nefesh that put a Prusbo in place before Shnat HaShemitah, not just towards the end of the Shnat HaShemitah. The difficulty with that is if you do put it in place then, you still need to put in place a Prusbo at the end of the Shnat HaShemitah, because the Prusbo is only effective for all loans that are outstanding until the point of the Prusbo. Anything that happens after the Prusbo is not covered by the Prusbo. So any Prusbo that goes into effect, you have to make sure that it covers all loans. You want to do it the latest date possible. So that's number one as far as Shemitah Ksafim, at the timing of Shemitah Ksafim. The second question is, how does Shemitah Ksafim take place? So here, the Minchat Chinuch brings down a Chakira, which is well known within Shemitah itself, which is that when we say that there's Shemitah or Shemitah Rakarka during Shemitah, what does that mean? Does that mean that it's what's called Afkata Demalko? That's a terminology that the Gemara uses in a number of places, which is, it's the king's declaration, or basically eminent domain. God has ultimate control over the land, and he says that on the seventh year it's going to be a Shemitah, and therefore everything is free and Hefker. I mean, the Balim do not have to declare their land Hefker, that it's Hefker automatically, because Hashem said that the Shemitah happens in that way. Or do we say that the Torah demands that the Balim, the owners of the karka, are mafkir their karka, that they open up their land to the other people so that they can come and take the fruits and they can take the produce that's on the land? So is Shemitah afkata demalko or Shemitah dependent on the Balim? The Minchat Chinuch says the same thing applies with regards to Shemitat Ksafim. When it comes to Shemitat Ksafim, the Yireim believes that Shemitat Ksafim requires the Malveh, the lender of the money, to say, Mishametani, that I am releasing you from the loan. And until or unless the Balim say Mishametani, then the loan is still intact. Or in other words, the borrower must repay the loan. It's the Balim, the owners, or the Malveh, that declares Mishametani. On the other hand, the Or Zarua and the, again, majority of the Rishonim, kimat all the other Rishonim, say that it's afkata demalko. The loan is automatically forgiven. I mean, HaKadosh Baruch Hu sets it that Shemitah Ksafim happens, and the loan is automatically forgiven. So then, why does the Malveh have to say Mishametani? The Mishnayot in Shvi'it tell us that when the borrower comes to repay the loan, the malve, the lender, has to say Mishametani. According to the Urim, it makes sense, because that's how the loan becomes forgiven, is that the malve says Mishametani. According to the Or Zeruah and all the other Rishonim, where it happens automatically, why does the malve have to say Mishametani? That is because he has to let the love know that he has no obligation to repay. Meaning that once God has forgiven the loan, and now the borrower shows up to pay back the loan, the malve, the lender, has to say to the borrower, you do not have to pay me back. If the love then says, afal pi kain, despite that I want to repay the loan, then the malve has the right to accept it, and the Mishnayot and Shvi'it say, ruach achamim nochamenu, that the Ruach of the Chachamim is pleased by individuals who repay their loans after Shemitat Kesafim, because that is the proper way to behave, the proper way to act. Now, it might be connected to what the Shemitah eliminates. I mean, does the Shemitah eliminate the right of collection? And therefore, the loan is still outstanding. It's just that the right of collection then is taken away. That seems to be what the Urim is saying, that the loan is still outstanding, but the borrower doesn't have a right of collection. If he collects, he's violating an Isur, and that's why he has to say Mishametani. On the other hand, for the other Rishonim, it seems like the obligation goes away. That's why the lender has to say Mishametani to tell the borrower, you no longer have an obligation of repayment, yet there's still Ruach HaChamim Nochayimena, which is that he should still repay the loan, because despite the fact that maybe there's no obligation, there's still the proper way to behave is to return the money that you borrowed from that individual. Or you could even argue, according to those Rishonim, that the obligation always stays there, and it is the right of collection that is eliminated. It's just a question of who eliminates it. Is it the malve or God who eliminates that right of collection? Now, moving on to the next issue with regards to Shemitat Kesafim, which is what exactly is covered by Shemitat Kesafim. We already bumped into this earlier in the Masechta, that we said that when it comes to hakafa, credit at the store, or when it comes to a ketubah, they are not subject to Shemitat Kesafim. So there are different ways to deal with that. One is to distinguish between what's called a chov and what's called a loan. That only loans are subject to Shemitat Kesafim, obligations are not subject to Shemitat Kesafim. So there are things like a ketubah, which is simply an obligation, or credit at the store, which are obligations, those are not subject to Shemitat Kesafim, whereas things that are outstanding loans, so therefore, that's what we saw before in the Gemara, that when the woman is zakfala, when she goes to Beit Din and demands payment or ketubah, it changes from an obligation then to a loan, where she says, I want repayment because the money is now owed to me and I want it. Or when the balachanut, the ostara owner, says, time to pay the credit that I've extended to you, then that turns it from an obligation into a loan, and that is subject to Shemitat Kesafim. That's one way to distinguish between what's called a chov and a halva'ah. Obviously, that has implications with regards to, first of all, bank deposits or other things where they may not be subject to Shemitat Kesafim, because they might just be obligations and not necessarily loans in the traditional sense of loans. Right, so based on that, obligations that come through transactional natures and not because of borrowing money would not be subject to Shemitat Kesafim. It would only be loans that would be subject to Shemitat Kesafim. There are others that argue that that distinction does not really exist, that even these types of obligations would create a Shemitat Kesafim. But the nature of the difference is when it becomes something that is subject to what's lo yigos, where collection. That once a person pushes for collection, that is what makes it into something that's subject to Shemitat Kesafim. As long as the individual does not want to collect on or is not demanding collection, then it's not subject to Shemitat Kesafim. Which we see in the Gemara, for instance, if one sets out a loan that is going to last for 10 years and there's no demand for payment until after 10 years, it will not be subject to Shemitat Kesafim. Because here the creditor cannot make demand for repayment during the Shemitah year. Since he can't make demand for repayment, the Shemitah year does not affect it. So therefore, it goes through the Shemitah year without any problem. Right, it might be interesting. It depends how you view a check. If a check is readily depositable now, and they're not post-dated checks, then they should be subject to Shemitah Kesafim because you have the ability to collect immediately. On the other hand, if you have post-dated checks, well, you don't have a right of collection now because you only have a right of collection once the date comes about, and that's post-Shemitah, then that may not be subject to Shemitah Kesafim because you can't collect the money. That all assumes that a check has a din of a loan. Today, where checks are used almost as live currency, when you hand a check to someone, it's not expected that that's a loan to them. They expect that that is ready available cash or the equivalent of cash. And if that's the case, then you wouldn't view it as a halva, you'd view it as mizuman, and then it wouldn't be subject to Shemitah Kesafim. That would be subject to what we said before. If you think that things are generated through transactions are not subject to Shemitah Kesafim, then it would not be. But if you believe that even transactional things that come for credit and they're going to pull the credit, then the Tashlumim would matter when they can collect it. Meaning that if the Tashlumim extend beyond the Shemitah year and they can't collect before that, then the Shemitah would not affect those payments that are afterwards. Right, the ones that are due before might be subject to Shemitah Kesafim. Again, it depends how you view the nature of Shemitah Kesafim. Then, over here, the Gemara says that there is a Hekesh between Shemitah HaKarka and Shemitah Kesafim. Shemitah Kesafim is not a mitzvah tluya ba'aretz. Since it's not a mitzvah tluya ba'aretz, it should not be, first of all, subject to only being true within Eretz Yisrael. It should be true whether you're in Eretz Yisrael or in Chutz La'aretz. Number two is that even when B'teila Kedushat Aret, then mitzvah of Shemitah Kesafim should still be extant because it's not connected to the land itself or the Kedushat Haaretz. But what you see here, and that's the nature of this Hekesh, is that this Hekesh tells us that that is not true, despite the fact that Shemitah Kesafim is independent. Here, the Torah connects it to Shemitah HaKarka. Which Shemitah HaKarka is subject to Machlok Pishonim? Which I think has nafkaminot over here. Rashi says that the Hekesh here is between Shemitah HaKarka and Shemitah Kesafim, which is that when Shemitah HaKarka is in effect, then Shemitah Kesafim is in effect. And that's what Abaye is saying now, that when Rabbi says that today Shemitah Kesafim is midrabanan, is because Shemitah HaKarka doesn't exist today midoraita, it only exists midrabanan. Therefore, Shemitah Kesafim also only exists midrabanan. And Rashi says it explicitly. He says, "Kugon she'achshav she'b'teila kedushat aretz." Today, where there is no kedushat aretz, then you don't have Shemitah Kesafim. Now, Rashi's statement is not so straightforward because it's possible that Shemitah does not happen today, even though kedushat aretz might still exist, and that might be because of the rules of Shemitah. Shemitah HaKarka might not be just alone dependent on whether there's kedushat aretz or not kedushat aretz, but might be connected to whether Yovel is in effect or Yovel is not in effect. That only when the Yovel is working does Shemitah have a din d'oraita. Rashi himself mentions it before that that's the case. And therefore you wouldn't have to say that there's no kedushat aretz. You might just say because the Yovel is not in effect, therefore there's no Shemitah. And you could segregate between the two issues and say that kedushat aretz is extant and is still around, but Shemitah doesn't apply. Rashi is connecting between the two and saying that, well, if the Yovel is no around, there is no Kedushat Aretz. That might have enough. I mean, the Rambam seems to make such a distinction that Kedushat Aretz might be extant now, but you still may not be obligated in Shemitah HaKarka, or possibly in Truma, because they have obligations that are tied to other factors, including the Yovel. And so that even though the Kedushat Aretz is around, you could still have it. There'd be that Shemitah HaKarka is only midrabanan. But Rashi clearly connects between Shemitah HaKarka, meaning that Shvi'it, when Shvi'it is Doraita, then Shemitah Kesafim is Doraita. When Shemitah is Derabonon, then Shemitah Kesafim is Derabanan. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Tam is brought in the Tosfot over here. Many of the other Yishonim think that Rashi's explanation is not correct, but rather when the Gemara here says Shemitah HaKarka and Shemitah Kesafim, they are referencing to the Yovel. They're not referencing to Shemitah HaKarka in the sense that we think of Shemitah the seventh year, but rather they are referencing to the Yovel, the Shemitah HaKarka, then, which is the fact that all the karka goes back to its original owner. And that's the Shemitah HaKarka that they're speaking about. And the Hekesh is this way. When the Yovel is in effect, and karka returns to its owners every 50 years at the Jubilee year, then Shemitah is in effect. Shemitah being both Shemitah HaKarka and Shemitah Kesafim. Both are affected by the fact that whether the Yovel is working or not. When the Yovel is in force, then that also impacts on the Shemitah Kesafim and the Shemitah HaKarka. Now Rashi agrees that Shemitah HaKarka is dependent on the Yovel. But Rashi thinks that the Hekesh between Shemitah HaKarka of Shemitah to Shemitah Kesafim. I wanted to suggest that the difference in their limud might also affect what we said before, which is that we asked before whether Shemitah Kesafim is Afkata Demalko or Shemitah Kesafim dependent on the Malveh. That might have to do with what you think Shemitah Kesafim is connected to. Shemitah Dakarko, when it comes to Shemitah in the seventh year, it's more akin to what we call Shabbat, like every 7 days when we have Shabbat, where Mekadesh Shabbat, God makes it that every 7 days it's Shabbat, whether we like it or not. Shabbat comes, and the Chiyuvim of Shabbat happen. It's not dependent on us, it's not dependent on us being Mekadesh the Shabbat. They, as the Baran Beitza says, Shabbat is Kitcha of the Kaima, that it exists, and it's already Kadosh. Shemitah, and Rav Aaron Lichtenstein has a beautiful article about this, comparing Shabbat and Shemitah, and Yovel and Yom Tov. But the idea being that Shemitah, in its parallel to Shabbat, both in the way that the Torah describes it, the language that is used, as well as the nature of the mitzvot, is similar in that way in Afkalta the Malka. Shvit comes, the land is not worked because there's Kedushat Haaretz, because it's the seventh year. It doesn't matter what you say, how you think about it, it's whether you count or you didn't count. Shemitah happens just like Shabbat. On the other hand, when it comes to Yovel, Yovel requires the decoration of Beitin. And that Beit Din has to declare it to Yovel and has to blow the shofar. And if you look at the Midrashei Halacha with regards to Yovel, it says over there that if the Beit Din doesn't blow the shofar, it's very possible that the slaves don't go free and the land doesn't return. I mean that Yovel is dependent on the counting of Beit Din. Beit Din has to count the 50 of the years, and then in the 50th year, Mekadesh the Yovel. That is something akin to Yom Tov. The way that our Yom Tov works is Mekadesh Yisrael Vazmanim. That it's dependent on our being Mekadesh, the Chodesh, and the calendar, and that determines when Yom Tov is. But the Kedusha is an imposed Kedusha based on our setting of the calendar, and has, obviously, impact on both the Melachot of Shabbat, the Melachot of Yom Tov because of that, the nature of the Melachot, or the Easter Melacha is different because of that, and the nature of Shabbat and Yom Tov is different. Similarly, the nature of Shemitah and Yovel are different. Even though Shemitah involves Shemitah Akarka, and you can't work the land, and Yovel has the same idea that you can't work the land, they're coming from a different perspective. Shemitah is coming from that perspective of Shabbat, that it happens no matter what, and there's Kedusha on the seventh year. Yovel is dependent on our input. If you say that, then the Hekesh to Shemitah Ksafim might have some information about Shemitah Ksafim. If you connect Shemitah Ksafim to Shemitah Akarka like Rashi, you connect it to the actual Shemitah, then, just like Shemitah Dakarka is Afkata Damalka, it happens, it's Kidshah V'kaimah, that God says that the seventh year is that way, so too by Shemitah Ksafim, you could argue that it automatically happens, and the loans are forgiven. On the other hand, if you connect it to Yovel, you could suggest that that also impacts in terms of the nature of the forgiveness of the loans. If Shemitah Ksafim is connected to Yovel, just like Yovel is dependent on our declaring the Yovel and making it into Yovel, so too, maybe Shemitah Ksafim is dependent on our declaring Mishameitani, that I forgive the loan, and that is like what the Yoreim says, is that the Malveh has to forgive the loan. It's not Mukhrach, but I think that it's compelling to say that if you connect the two ideas, depending if you connect Shemitah Ksafim to Shemitah, or you connect Shemitah Ksafim to Yovel, might have impact in that area as to how you view the nature of Shemitah Ksafim. Your question is an important question that the Gemara in Arachim takes up. We're not going to spend a lot of time on it, but it's a very important question, which is that when you don't have any Yovel because Beit Din's not counting, because there's a requirement of Rov Yoshve Aleha, that the only time that we count the Yovel is when the majority of Jews in the world are inhabiting or live in Eretz Yisrael. That's a requirement of Rov Yoshev Aleha. Right, so we are on the precipice of that. Probably over the next 6-7 years, that probably will shift in favor of the majority of Jews in the world being in Eretz Yisrael, and will have impact that has to be dealt with halachically, which will not be simple. But right now, that is not the case. And therefore, because there is no Yovel Min HaTorah, Shemitah is only Mid Rabbanan, and so too, Shemitah Ksafim is only Mid Rabbanan. Now, what do you do in an instance where Yovel is only Midrabanan? So it seems from the Gemara in Arachin in the time of Bayit Sheni that Midrabanan, they used to put Yovel in as a placeholder. And that they used to count the 49 years, then the 50th year would be Yovel, and then they would start a new 49-year cycle. So Yovel would be nothing, it wouldn't be important as a year, but it was a placeholder that they used to wait the year out. Afterwards, it seemingly they switched to a system by which in the time of the Gonim, they stopped counting that placeholder year of the Yovel. The Rambam, when he comes to codify the halacha, says that he thinks that the right way to do this is to count the 50 years, put the Yovel in as a placeholder, and then continue counting the Shemitah cycle. But the Rambam, it's an amazing statement by the Rambam, and it basically preserves halacha, which he says that despite the fact that I think that's the right way, I am going to defer to the tradition of the Gaonim, And we're going to continue to count the Shemitah cycles based on the 49 without the 50th year there. It's amazing only because the Rambam, in his deference there, allows for us to have a single Shemitah today. The fact that all of Klal Yisrael keeps 1 year as the Shemitah year is miraculous in nature, because there's so many different opinions as how to count and which year is the Shemitah year. And because of that, if we really looked at all the Rishonim, you'd have 4 out of the 7 years would be Shemitah, because we just don't know which year is Shemitah. The fact that everybody came to Askama as which year is Shemitah is amazing. Part of it has to do with this Rambam. There, the Raivud on the Rambam criticizes the Rambam, says he thinks the Rambam's right, and that you should count the Yovel year, and that the Rambam shouldn't have deferred to the Geonim. It's the only time in the Yad HaZakah where the Rambam paskins against himself, and the Raivud says the Rambam should paskin like himself. It's the only time in Mishnah Torah where the Raivud says the Rambam is wrong, because he should have paskin like he said. But there you have a machloket Rishonim, a very big machloket Rishonim in the Gemara in Arachin. Again, we're not going to spend a lot of time on it, as to what to do with the Yovel when the Yovel is not Doraita. What is important here is the Shita of the Rabbeinu Tam. The Rabbeinu Tam over here discusses the question of if the Yovel is extant from our Gemara based on what we said here. Rashi says connects it to Shemitah Rakarka. The other hand, the Rabbeinu Tam connects it to Yovel. So most Rishonim believe that Yovel was not extant during the time of Bayit Sheni. They already did not have Rov Yoshvei Aleha from already the time that the Ten Shvatim were put into Galut. Once the Ten Shvatim are put into Galut, you don't have the majority of Jews living in Eretz Yisrael, and therefore the Yovel is no longer Doraita already from that time. The Rabbeinu Tam here in this Tosafot argues on that and says that's not the case. That Yovel was in practice during Bayit Sheni, and he proves it from the fact that the institution of Eved Ivri and the institution of Batei Arei Choma, which are connected to Yovel, or in practice during Bayit Sheni. It says the only way they can be in practice is if the Yovel was in practice. And therefore, the Rabbeinu Tam says two things that are a big chiddush. One is that for the Yovel, you don't necessarily need Rov Yoshvei Aleha, you just need representatives from every Shevet. So if you have a representative from every Shevet, then you can, quote-unquote, declare or have a Yovel. You don't need Rov Yoshvei Aleha, but just a representative from every Shevet. And then you have to rely on the Midrash, that says that Yirmiyahu Navi brought the Aseret Shvatim back after the Galut of the Aseret Shvatim. Yirmiyahu brings them back in the time of Yoshiyahu HaMelech. And therefore, you do have representatives of all of the Shvatim. And that's why they had the Yovel in practice during Bayit Sheni, according to the Rabbeinu Tam. Now, it's a midrash that Yirmiyahu brought them back, although there's evidence in the text. If you look by Yoshiyahu HaMelech, the evidence in the text is the fact that they are sending out messengers about the Korban HaPesach to areas that are outside of Yehuda. Outside of the areas of Yehuda and Binyamin, they're sending messengers for people to keep Pesach. Who's there? Who's living over there that they have to send out messengers to? That's where the Midrash draws the idea that the Aseret HaShvatim had been brought back, because otherwise why is he sending out messengers to places beyond Yehuda and Binyamin? So based on that, the Rabbeinu Tam says that Yovel was in effect Doraita. The problem that the Rabbeinu Tam then faces is that over here, what the Gemara is saying is that Hillel was mitakein puzbo because the Shemitah Ksafim is derabanan. According to Rabbeinu Tam, during the time of Bayit Sheni, Shemitah Ksafim was deoraita. Hillel lives while the Beit HaMikdash is still extant. So then the Rabbeinu Tam has to come up with a very difficult solution here, which is to say that when it says Hillel was mitakein the puzbo, it wasn't for his generation, but for the Churban, when he saw the Churban HaBayit was coming within the next 100 years, therefore he instituted for when the Churban comes. It's a very difficult statement, especially since in the second half of today's daf, the Gemara is going to ask the question explicitly. Was Hillel attacking Puzbo for his generation, or for future generations as well? The Rabbeinu Tam has to explain that. What does it mean, his generation? Not literally his generation, but the generation of the Churban, which is a very difficult explanation. For that reason, even those Rishonim that agree with the Baal HaTosafot, that the Hekesh here is between Yovel and Shemitah Ksafim, they still say that in the time of Bayit Sheni, the Yovel was not, in effect, Midoraita, because of this problem that the Rabbeinu Tam faces that makes it very difficult. But the Rabbeinu Tam is of a Shita, that Yovel is Doraita during Bayit Sheni, and so is Shemitah Ksafim Doraita during Bayit Sheni. Now, in terms of the appeal of connecting Shemitah Ksafim to Yovel versus connecting it to Shemitah Rakarka, that is because if you think of the Yovel as being the Jubilee year, or basically the zenith, the peak of what Hashem wants to demonstrate, which is that the Yovel unwinds everything that's happened in the last 50 years, that anybody who sold land, anybody that lend money, anybody who became enslaved over the last 50 years, everything goes free, everything is reversed in the Yovel. That means every 50 years, there's a reset in terms of the social standing of all the individuals, and all people in the economy get a second chance at the Yovel. All property that they sold comes back. If they had to sell themselves into slavery because of difficult economic situation, they go free during the Yovel. All of those things are reversed during the Yovel. What you then would have is that during the years through the 50th year, that's a long time to wait. Meaning that for most individuals, they will see one, maybe two Yovels during their lifetime. It's very possible they'd only see one Yovel. And it means that they only get one reset in their life. And it's not even clear when in their lifespan it would be. It could be, you know, when they're much older. It could be when they're very young. And therefore, it would be difficult to set a social structure by which that only happens once every 50 years, even though it's a great idea. It's a beautiful idea. First of all, that demonstrates that God is really the owner of everything, and God is the one who grants everything, and we are just subject to that temporary ownership under God's auspices. But if you only have that every 50 years, it's less impactful. And so what I heard from Rav Meir Lichtenstein, a beautiful idea, is that the Torah has smaller cycles that are basically mini yovels that take place through the cycles. That's true by karka, and that's also true by ksafim. By karka, the yovel says all land goes back to its original owners. Same thing is true by shmitat hakarka. So in shmitat hakarka, you don't have the land go back to its original owners, but the land is hefker during the shmita year. That is impact from both sides. The owner of the land is in a sense disowned from the land for a year. It's not that it goes back like the yovel, but he's disowned during that year. In addition, those that are socially needy are able then to go into the fields and take what they need, meaning that the social net is there. So during the 7 years, the 6 years, you have the trumot, masrot, the matnot, aniyim that create that social safety net. Then you have shmitah akarka, which is like a bigger cycle, where shmitah creates that bigger safety net where you're disowned of your land in a sense, and the indication that God owns the land, not you, and that the aniyim get a chance at the land. Then you have the big cycle, which is the 50-year cycle, where all the land goes back to its original owners. So there you have these mini cycles that are running inside of the yovel. The same would then be true with regards to shmitat ksafim. What's the idea of shmitat ksafim? Is the forgiveness of the loans. The same way that yovel undertakes to reverse all the transactions and all the different social structures that have been built during that period of time by unwinding all the ownership and giving it back to its original owners, so too, in a mini way, the shmitat ksafim in every 7 years does the same thing by freeing people from the loans or the burden of the loans that's on them. Yeah, people have become indebted during that period of time. They're indebted. If they can't escape that burden of the debt, then they are unable to restart or get a fresh start. And so because of that, the Torah gives you a mini cycle. That is the 7 year cycle of Shemitah Safim that leads into the Yovel, whereas the ultimate cycle that releases everything in the Yovel. So that'd be a nice idea in terms of connecting Shemitah Safim to the Yovel, because it's a mini cycle of that which is taking place to the Yovel. Now, if you look in the Torah carefully in Sefer Vayikra, at the end of Sefer Vayikra, where the Torah says one may not lend with interest, and the same would then be true with regards to loans that are made, that are forgiven by the Shemitah, the nature of loans in the Torah is that you're lending to people who are needy. You're not lending people money for business transactions. You're not lending money people to start a business. You're lending money to people who are in desperate straits, and that they have nothing. They own nothing and they have nothing, and you're lending them money basically as their last resort. So there the Torah says you may not charge interest to those people because, in a sense, that's usurious. You are basically taking advantage of someone in a difficult predicament, and you are charging them interest. You're basically killing them by taking interest in that situation. Number two is the forgiveness of the loan and the Shemitah is basically because what the Torah is telling you is that that money that you have and that you're lending to this individual is tzedakah. Not tzedakah necessarily in the sense of charity, but tzedakah in the sense of that God tells you that if you have more money than you need, that you have to return it to its rightful owners or to those people who are needy. And then when you lend the money to them, it's more in a sense of matana than a sense of loan. Like not today where we think you're lending money and expecting it to get paid back, but rather a grant to an individual. If they pay it back, they pay it back. But in general, it's supposed to be a grant or it's stuck out. And that's the nature of that type of lending. And that's what the Shemitah is no'ad, or Shemitah Ksavim is to forgive, which is to not have people collect against those individuals because these individuals really were in desperate need, and they borrowed the money because of that desperation, and it really was a loan of stakah, not a loan in the sense of lending. The reason that makes a big difference is because the takanot of Prusbo, as well as Heter Iska, come to solve that problem, which is that over time, the nature of lending and the nature of borrowing change. Now, people today borrow money not because they're in desperate need, because it's seen as a vehicle or a means for doing business. So that people borrow money, whether it's to buy a house, or they borrow money to start a business, not because that's the only way they can do it or they're in desperate need, but because it's financially sound or a good way to start a business or to buy a house. There's value in borrowing the money. Over there, the Torah, even though Shemitah Kesafim technically affects it, in terms of the ruach, or the spirit of Shemitah Kesafim, that's not what the Torah was really speaking about. It wasn't speaking about indebtedness where people willingly enter it in order to finance a project or finance a house or a car. That's not really what the Torah was indicating, Shemitah Kesafim, that, oh, you don't have to pay it back. You don't have to pay your loans back. That really wasn't what the Torah was indicating. The idea of the Torah was in cases where it's tzedakah. So in order to deal with that, the takana of Hillel in terms of Prusbo and the Heter Iska for regards to interest is a way to deal with the changing nature of borrowing, where borrowing is not simply people who are desperate or in need, but borrowing is used as a normal vehicle of commerce. And to deal with that, you have the Prusbo and you have the Heter Iska, which allow people to engage in these items in a normal, financially sound way without having the Torah's rules come in and make it not feasible, because it doesn't make sense to lend businesses money so they're not going to repay you at the end of 7 years. So the Takana Prusbo as well as the Heter Iska come out from a need of the changing nature of these types of transactions. And that you have to keep in the back of your mind when all of this is going on, which is the Torah's description of a loan is very different than our conception of lending and borrowing that we have today, which is also developing in the time of the Gemara already. When you're moving from a more agrarian society to a commerce or transactional society where business and not the ownership of land can be the determinant of whether one is successful. And we saw that change also with regards to the Gonim and Ketubot. That originally Ketubot were only encumbered against real property or land. The Gonim Institute that you can go after Metaltalim because they're wealthy, wealthy individuals who don't own a piece of land because commerce and trading and money become a way to gather wealth and to live, even though you own no land. And then ownership of land is not the only indicator of wealth. And so because of that, we see by the ketubot, they changed what you can collect the ketubah from. That ketubot are encumbered on metaltalim because of that change in the nature of the way that people transacted and lived. And the same thing is happening here with regards to Prusbo, Heter Iska, all these are happening in a very similar manner, which is that change from an agrarian society to a commerce or trading-based society. All right, so now what we have here, according to Abaye, is that Hillel is mitakein Prusbo in order to overcome this problem of people not lending money, but he does it only in the case, according to Abaye, where it's midrabanan, where Shemitah is derabanan. Had Shemitah been d'oraita, what would be the din? Here you have a machlok between Rashi and the Tosafot. Rashi indicates here that the only reason it seems to work is because it's Shemitah d'rabanan. Since Shemitah is d'rabanan, therefore you can have Prusbo. Without Shemitah d'rabanan, Prusbo doesn't exist. There's a Mishnah in Shvi'it, the Mishnah before the one we just quoted about Prusbo. The Mishnah there says that Hamoser Shterotav the Beitin, Ain't a Shemitah Mishametet. That someone who gives over his documents to Beit Din, the Shemitah is not Mishamet those documents. The question that you have to ask is, how is that different than Prusbo? Why is one Mishnah talking about Mosrei and Shtorotav the Beit Din, and then the next Mishnah talks about Prusbo? How is Prusbo different than being Mosrei Shtorotav the Beit Din, which is effectively what Prusbo is? Rashi says they're synonymous. That's what it means. Prusbo is just the institution of being Mosrei Shtorotav to Beit Din. And therefore Rashi believes that Moser Shtorotav the Beit Din or Prusbo is only effective, like Abaye says here, when Shemitah is derabanan. When Shemitah is d'oraita, it does not help you, it does not work at all. On the other hand, Tosafot over here says that there are two different dinim. There's a din of Moser Shtorotav the Beit Din, you give over your shtorot to Beit Din, which it works even when Shemitah is d'oraita. So then, what was the takana of Hillel? You could do this even when Shemitah is d'oraita, you can hand over your contracts to Beit Din. So then what's this institution of Prusbol? So the Balei HaTosfot tell us that what Prusbol did was make it that, that became the default status in a sense. That Hillel encouraged people to be Moser Shtarotah of the Beit Din. And that's the nature of the Gemara's question here. Why was Hillel mitakein something, you're right, that works no raita, but why would he encourage people to do this, which effectively is circumventing the din of Shemitah? Why would he institute something like this? The answer is because Shemitah went to be Drabonon, and therefore Hillel encouraged people to do this because otherwise they weren't lending money. So Hillel's encouragement of people to be Moser Shtarotam, the Beit Din, is because Shemitah went to be Drabonon. But what you see from the Balei HaTosafot is that even when Shemitah is Doraita, if you give over your Shtarot to Beit Din, that works in order to overcome the problem of Shemitah. Now Rashi says that that's not the case. Well, why not? Because there is generally a din of lo yigos, which is that only if you can force collection is there a subject to Shemitah Kesafim. If you don't force collection, then there is not subject to Shemitah Kesafim. The Tosafot here quotes the Sifrei, which is Tashmet Yadecha, and brings another source for it. And in that Sifrei, it says that Moser Shtarotav, the Beit Din, is not subject to Shemitah. But for Rashi, who says it is subject to Shemitah, what you have to say is that effectively, when you give over your documents to Beit Din, you have not stopped the process of Lo Yigos. Because actually, you have effectively done it even better. If you think about it, until now, you could only collect the Shtarot by yourself. Now you give them over to Beit Din and say that Beit Din could collect on your behalf. Beit Din is a more powerful collection agent than you are. So in a sense, you've actually improved your ability to collect because you basically handed over your documents to the sheriff. And now the sheriff is going to collect on your behalf. And that might be why Rashi believes that Moser Shtarotav, the Beit Din, is not effective as a means to overcome Shemitah when Shemitah is Doraita. Because yes, giving over to Beit Din means you're not collecting, but that Beit Din now becomes, and effectively your shliach becomes your emissary to collect on your behalf, and they're a better collector. It's as if you handed it over to a collection agency. And now they're going to go after these people to collect. And in that case, you've actually improved your collectability and not ruined your collectability. And for that reason, maybe why Rashi believes that Moser Shtarotav, the Beit Din, is not a way to get around Shemitah. And that's why you need Shemitah Rabbonon and the Takana of the Prusbol in order to do that. But had it been Shemitah Doraita, Rashi says that will not work. That will not be effective means of collecting. And the Balei Tosafot answer on behalf of Rashi that the phrase that mentions that drush of Tashmet Yadecha is Ikar has to do with the mashkon. If you lend on a mashkon, since it's already as if the loan is collected because you have collateral, then it's not subject to Shemitah. But when it comes to Moser Shtarotav the Beit Din, that's just an asmachta for a Prusbol, but that's not really learnt out of that limud from the Pasuk. And that's why Rashi believes it's only effective when Shemitah is Derabanan, not when Shemitah is Doraita. Right, so now, continuing the Gemara, now that we've established that Shemitah is Derabanan, therefore, Takinu Rabbanan, the Tishamet, Zecher L'Shvi'it. So what the Rabbanan did was, even though Shemitah Kesafim is not applicable today, either according to Rashi, because there's no Shemitah Rakarka, or according to the other Rishonim, because Yovel is not extant, therefore there is no Shemitah. And then why are you worried about the loans being forgiven? Why are loans being forgiven at all? The answer is, Takinu Rabbanan, the Tashmit, Zecher L'Shvi'it. Zecher L'Shvi'it, the Rabbanan put in place that there should be Shemitat Kesafim, so that the whole institution doesn't fall by the wayside. That, by the way, was what the Ramban says about why don't we just write into every document that it's not subject to Shemitah. Meaning that we have a principle that you can put in any conditions with monetary transactions, even though it goes against the din of the Torah, because you can have it tznai by mamon, even though it overrides what the Torah says, like by shomrim. The Torah prescribes default situations. But you can override the default by specifying in the shtar that it's not subject to those rules. So why don't you just write it into the document it's not subject to Shemitah Kesafim? So Ramban says the problem with that is that you would basically eliminate Shemitah Kesafim. The institution of Shemitah Kesafim would go by the wayside because you would never have it. Over here, where you have a Prusbol in place, everybody remembers Shemitah Kesafim and then they put the Prusbol in place. So Shemitah Kesafim still exists, at least. Or the problem is that people will forget. And if they forget and then don't have a Prusbol, they really will lose the loans. So Ramban says that's why they didn't institute to put it into the contracts themselves. But the Rabbanan want here to have a Zecher L'Shvi'it. Tosafot asks a very interesting question. Well, if they made Zecher L'Shmitah Kesafim, why didn't they make a Zecher L'Yovel? How come we don't have a Zecher L'Yovel? So the Tosafot over here says Says that people would not be able to handle it. If you think now Shemitah is hard here in Eretz Yisrael and all the produce and going through the Shemitah year, if you had back-to-back Shemitah years, if you had Shemitah and then Yovel, Zecher Yovel, it would be almost impossible for the Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael to exist, especially in the past. Even today, it would be very difficult economically to have the agricultural economy survive 2 years where they didn't plant. So Tosafot says that's why they did not institute a Zecher LeYovel and only instituted a Zecher LeShmita or Zecher LeShmita Tzafim. So then, So Hillel saw, even after the Chachamim instituted this Shmita Tzafim deRabbanan, that people stopped lending. Amad bitkin Pruzbol, and therefore he institutes Pruzbol. But now, mi ika mi de midoraita lo misham to shvit. So now we ask the question the opposite way. Before we wanted to know, if things are really nishmat midoraita, meaning that there's shmita doraita, how could Hillel come and override shmita doraita? The answer was, shmita is only derabanan. So now the Gemara is going the opposite way. If shmita is only midorabanan, that means midoraita, these loans are still outstanding, and they have to be repaid. So how could it be here that midi midoraita lo mishamto to shvit, mina Torah, these loans have to be repaid? That shmita ksavim is not impactful on them, but tekin rabanan to tishamet. And then the Rabbanan come and say, yes, you know what? The loans are forgiven. How does the Rabbanan come here and have loans be forgiven when the Torah says that these loans are still outstanding and you have a mitzvah to repay the loans? Amar Abaye, shev ve'altasehu. It's passively. They do this. This is what we know from many places in Shas, that the Chachamim have a right to be oker davar min Torah b'shev ve'altaseh. That through passiveness that the Chachamim can demand a person not keep a mitzvah d'oraita. We have that by tkiat shofar on Shabbat, the taking of lulav on Shabbat, the chamim say, shev al tase, just be passive and don't do it, even though that's a violation of a mitzvah tase d'oraita. Similarly here, when it comes to the repayment of the loan, there is a mitzvah to repay the loan, the chamim say, shev al tase, just be passive and do not repay the loan. Now you could explain this in one of two ways. Who is being passive over here? Is it the love or the malve? You could say that they're demanding that the Lova be passive and not do the mitzvah of repaying the loan. Or you could argue that it's the Malva is passive and doesn't go and collect the loan. That he doesn't exercise his right of collection. They're saying Shev Al Taseh. And that's the mitzvah that's being demanded over here in Shev Al Taseh. But either way, what is being said here, seemingly by Abaye, is the reason that they are allowed the Pruzbol to work is because Shemitah is Dirabanan. Since Shemitah is Dirabanan, Pruzbol works. Now, how did the Rabbanan institute Shemitah Ksafim if midoraita there is no Shemitah Ksafim? That comes to Shev V'altaseh. That's Abaye's explanation of this. Rova comes along and says, no, it's functioning differently. Rav Amar Hefker Beitin Haya Hefker. That's based on the ability of Beitin to basically exercise eminent domain and take away people's property. Damar Rabbi Yitzchak Minayin Shefker Beitin Haya Hefker. From where do you know that Hefker Beitin Hefker works? Shinamar, because it says in the Pasuk in Ezra, again, we've seen this before in Gemara and Yivamot, B'chol asher lo yavol l'shloshet hayamim katzat asarim v'azkenim. Anybody who doesn't show up in the next 3 days to make aliyah to Eretz Yisrael, because we've gotten permission now to go up to Eretz Yisrael, if you don't show up, then based on the psak of the Beitin and the Sarim, yacharam kol rechusho, then all of his possessions will be confiscated, disowned from him, and he'll be segregated from the Kalagola, meaning that he will stand out in that way, which is that he won't be part of us, the Kehila or Bnei Yisrael that are older than the Aretz, and he'll lose all of his property or his possessions and be disowned of them. So you see here the power of Beitin to disown someone from their property. Rabbi Lezer Omer Mahacha, Rabbi Lezer says the source is from here. These are the lands or the properties that were granted as inheritance by Elazar HaKohen, the Kohen Gadol, Yoshua ben Nun, who is the Melech or the leader, Roshei HaAvot, and the fathers, the heads of the fathers. V'chi Ma'inyan Roshim Itzel Avot. Why is Roshei HaAvot significant over here? It should have said Roshei HaMatot. It should have said the heads of the Shvatim, the heads of the people. I mean, it should be people of authority. What does Roshei HaAvot have to do with here? Lo Malacha. Ma'avot manchilim et bneihem, kol ma shiyirtzu. Just like parents or fathers can grant gifts or property to whomever they choose, afroshehem manchilim et am kol ma shiyirtzu. So too, the heads of the nation have the right to grant property to whomever they choose. So this is the source for the fact that Hefker baked in Hefker. Now, there are two psukim brought over here. The difference in these psukim also might have a impact on what the power of Beitin is when it comes to Hefker, Beitin, Hefker. If you look at these two psukim, spot down by the Dvar Avram, I think the Minchas Asher, but Asher Weitz also makes such a chakira here with regards to this difference in the psukim, which is, if you look at the first pasuk says that Beitin has the right to disown you from your property. The second pasuk says that Beitin has the right to move property, to take property or to give it to whomever they want. But what you see from here is that Beitin's power, depending on which source you see here, is different. According to one source, the power of Beitin is only to disown you from your property. They can separate you from your ownership of your property, but that's it. They can make your property hefker. They don't have the right to grant it to other parties. The other source here says that the power of Beitin, of hefker, Beitin, hefker, is not only to disown you from your property, but then to determine who gets that property or to give it to other parties. So now, based on that, you actually have a chakira here. How does hefker, Beitin work? Is hefker, Beitin, hefker just simply your property is now hefker, and therefore you don't own it, but we can't, then anybody who comes can take it or make that choice. Or can Beitin say, you no longer own your property, but so-and-so does own that property. That difference now will be impactful here in the interpretation of Rashi and Tosafot. Rashi over here says that when Rava comes and says here, hefker, Beitin, hefker, he's answering both questions that the Gemara asked. Remember, the Gemara asked two questions. Number one is, how can there be a prusbol when Shemitah's d'oraita? Shemitah d'oraita, you get prusbol. Abai's answer is, Shemitah d'rabanan. Then the Gemara asks the second question. If Shemitah is only me d'rabanan, how do the Chachamim institute Shemitah k'safim? Abai comes and answers, Shevi al tasei. Then Rava comes along and says, Hefker, Beitin, Hefker. Which question was Rava answering? From the Pashtut of Gemara is, Rava was only answering the second question. Not both of them. Rashi says over here that Rava is going back on everything. And he says, Olam ben the Rabbanan de pliga de Rabbi. That Rava believes that even according to the Rabbanan who think that Rabbi's wrong and Shemitah Mizvana says Doraita, the way that Prusbol works is Hefker, Beitin, Hefker. That Beitin has the right of Hefker, Beitin, Hefker. And therefore here, Rashi thinks it's the answer to both questions. The question of, well, how is it possible that when Shemitah is Doraita, that the Chamim can come along and say, still pay back the loan? The answer is, Hefker, Beitin, Hefker. What about the fact that if Shemitah is only Dirabonon, then how is the fact that they make Shemitah Ksafim happen? Hefker, Beitin, Hefker. But that's two different versions of Hefker, Beitin, Hefker. In the case of keeping Shemitah Dirabonon, then Shemitah Dirabonon is just disowning a person from their property. This individual lent money to another party, and now the Chachamim come along and say, Hefker, Beitin, Hefker, which says that you don't have to pay it back anymore. We disown this guy from his property. On the other hand, when it comes to if Shemitah Ksafim is Doraita, which says that you no longer own this property, you no longer have a right of collection, the Chachamim are coming along and say, Hefker, Beitin, Hefker, not only does the borrower not own the money anymore, but now he has to pay back. We're going to take away his money and he has to pay it back to some individual. They're demanding not only that you lose ownership of your property, but you have to give it to someone else. That's that second version of Hefker, Beitin, Hefker, that not only does Beitin have the right to disown you from your property, it has a right to now force you to give it to someone else, post a lover to pay back the malveh. And that might be what's driving Rashi over here, that Hefker, Beitin, Hefker has that power, and therefore he thinks that Rava's answer is about both of these aspects. On the other hand, for the Balei Tosafot, Rava's only answering the second question. He agrees with the Baye that the reason why we have prusbol is because derabonon, that the din of Shemitah Ksafim is only derabonon, and therefore prusbol works. That's Abaye. Rava is built on top of that. Then how come we can have Shemitah Ksafim during the time when Shemitah Doraita doesn't exist? How do you have Shemitah Ksafim derabonon? Hefker Beitin Hefker. That's the answer that replaces Shevi Al Tase. He says Hefker Beitin Hefker, but that's only the version of Hefker Beitin Hefker where Beitin can disown you from your property. Not the right of Beitin to give your property to someone else. And that might be what the Balei Tosafot are saying, or the other Rishonim are saying, that Hefker Beitin Hefker is only an ability to extract you or disown you from your property, not to give it to other parties. And therefore, Rava's answer only applied to that second answer of the Gemara. And similarly, that's the way that the Rambam paskins. Despite the fact that generally when you have Machloket Rava and Abaye, the Loche is like Rava except for Yal Kagam. We just had one of the Yal Kagams on Daf Lamed Daled, That was one of the places that we actually paskin like Abaye. But over here, the halacha should be like Rova. Yet, the Rambam paskins like Abaye and says that Shemitah is derabbanan and therefore Prusbo works. But what you have to say is that the Rambam is literally like the Balei HaTosafot, or in essence saying that Rova's Shita here is built on Abaye. The reason that he says Efker Beit and Efker is because he believes that the answer of Abaye, the Prusbo, is working because of Shemitah derabbanan. The Raiva there disagrees and says no, that even if it was Doraita, Prusbo would work. Seemingly the Raiva is taking up the Shita of Rashi, that Hefker, Beit, and Hefker, according to Rava, works both for the first answer and the second answer. That Rava, that has nothing to do with Abaye. Rava's answer is completely independent. If you pass him like Rava, you don't have to say Shemitah's Derabbanan to have Prusbo work. Even if Shemitah's Doraita, Prusbo could still work. And that's what the Raivad says. And similarly, that's what Rashi is suggesting over here in the Shita of Rava. Just to close out, we're going to deal with Prusbo and Shemitah Ksavim a little more over the remainder of today's daf and tomorrow's daf. But just to note that they developed a problem, which was that the Rishonim here discussed the fact that the Prusbo falls by the wayside. And that through the Middle Ages, for some reason, they are not seeing people put in place Prusbos. And the Rosh himself says that he was screaming like a chicken and making noises as to why people were not putting in a Prusbo. He says, I do not understand. And what the reason is that nobody is putting a Prusbo in place. Who let these people off the hook? So there are Rishonim who connected to Mitzvah Tzvuyot Baretz, and there seems to develop a mentality that Shemitah Ksafim is only applicable in Eretz Yisrael, or it's a Mitzvah Tzvuyot Baretz and not subject to Chutz Laretz. And therefore they are melamed zchut on these people who are not putting in place Prusbos because of that, or other reasons that they give here, the Rishonim. But in the end, what ends up happening, which is an amazing thing, is that in the last, I would say, 50 years, there's been a huge resurgence in the use of Prusbo and putting Prusbo in place again, which is what the Rishonim say should be happening and should be done. And that is both in Eretz Yisrael and in Chutz Laretz, that people should put in place Prusbo. And it's a beautiful thing today that it's done, and it's done easily, where people are actually engaging in it, and this Takanat Chachamim is really back in place. All right, so now the Gemara says, Ibailuhu. This is something that we mentioned before. Kiitkin Hillel Prusbo the Darehu de Takin, Hodim le Dari Da'alma Nami Takin. So when Hillel put the Prusbo in place, did he do it for his generation? Or did he put it in place as a permanent Takana? Again, this is the biggest problem for the Rabbeinu Tam Shita, that Hillel was not Metakin Prusbo for his generation, he did it for the generation of the Churban. Here the Gemara explicitly says, did Hillel do it during his generation or forever? So the Rabbeinu Tam gives that difficult answer that he did it for the first generation after the Churban. That was what it means, his generation. What's the difference whether it was Hillel or he did it L'Dari Alma, L'Ptule? Difference of whether you can annul this Takana. Iyamart L'Darehu D'Takin, if he only did it or instituted for his generation, then we can reverse the Takana of Hillel, because it does not have a status of Takana baked in that is permanent, and then you can't unwind it. On the other hand, Eliyahu Amar L'Dari Alma Nami Tokin, if you put this in place as a permanent Takana, then I ain't baked in Yechol Levatel Divrei Beitin Chavero Elim Kein Gadol Emenu B'Chuchma B'Minyan, that the only way that you a later Beitin can override an earlier Beitin's Takana is if it's greater in number and Chuchma, which generally is not the case. It's very hard to have that happen, and therefore, generally, when you have a gzeira, takanat chachamim, it's permanent, because later batei dinim cannot unwind that which earlier batei dinim dealt with. Over here, you can see there's a very large tosfot that questions, when does this principle apply? How do you know when a gzeira, takana, is subject to reversibility? And when is it not subject to reversibility? Depends on the nature of the takana or the gzeira. And certain gzeirot, the takanot that are put in place, are irreversible no matter what. Even if you have a beitin that's gadol b'menu b'chokhma u'b'minyan, other takanot you can when you have gadol b'menu b'chokhma u'b'minyan. And no, still others, takanot can be reversed even without all of that, because the takanot gzeirot was never accepted by the rov of the Am. Since it was never accepted by the rov of the Am, then you have abilities of later batitinim to unwind it or to reverse it. Now, generally, what we've seen is, and this is what Tosfot points out, that when that happens, sometimes the later Beit Din will try again to reinforce something that an earlier Beit Din puts in place, and sometimes they're successful, because later generations are able to accept that which was not before. So then, he says, when the Gemara asks about a Beit Din, why were they matir? According to Tosfot, it's not a question why they were matir. They were matir because Rov Bnei Yisrael did not accept it. What he says, the Gemara's question then is,
Why were they makdir and why didn't they just try to reinforce it? When they came along to unwind an earlier gzeirah, why didn't they try again to see if they could institute it and have Rav Bnei Yisrael accept it? And that's the nature of the Gemara's questions when a Beit Din is matir, not why were they matir, or were they permitted to be matir? No, they were permitted to matir because Rav Bnei Yisrael didn't accept it. But the question of the Gemara is, why didn't they try to help and reinforce it rather than unwind it? And that's what the nature of different questions Tosafot talks about throughout Shas, when we see certain Batei Dinim unwinding, like that of Rav Yehuda HaNasiah, which is the grandson of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasiah, who unwinds the Takana of Shemen HaShel Goyim, and the Gemara asks, why? How did he do that? Why did he do that? And there it has to do with the fact that Rav Bnei Yisrael did not accept it or did not go into effect. We find other gezeirot, like the Yud Chet Davar in the Gemara in Shabbat, which Tosfot here says here, could not be unwound no matter what. Even if you have a Beit and go Dov B'chokom Minyan, they were put in place because they were most certain of Shulteyam Aldiz Yud Chet Davar, and for that reason they're not able to be unwound no matter what. And then there are other takanot and gzeirot that sit between those two, which is that they were accepted, but they were not moser nefshot, and those are subject to the rules. If you have a beit din that's gadol b'mer b'chokh minyan, then it can be reversed. But Tosafot is trying to categorize different types of gzeirot and takanot, and when they are subject to reversal and when they're not subject to reversal, obviously this is a major machloket in the Gemara, in Beitzah, and other places where this sugya is discussed. All right, now, my, what is it? Which way was it? Tashma, Damar Shmuel, Lo Katvinan Puzbol, Ela Ibe Beidina de Sura, Ibe Beinedina de Nardo. That we only write a Puzbol when it's in the Beitin of Sura, which means the Beitin of Rav, or Ibe Beitin de Nardo, Nardo is of Shmuel. I mean, that they have to be strong and powerful, but they dinim. Visa Gadatcha de Dari Alma Nami Tukun, then if you say that they made it a permanent institution, Bishar Beidina Nami Lichtavu, then why can the Puzbol only be written in the primary Batei Dinim, that of Shmuel and Rav? Why weren't they written in any Beit Din? So he says, Dilma, keep talking Hillel to Dari Alma. Maybe that's the way that the Takana was put in place. That when Hillel instituted it for permanent or over the generations, Gon Beidina Didei. It had to be a Beit Din that was similar in stature to his Beit Din. Ukurav Ami, Ukurav Asi. Or similar to that of Rav Ami Razi, Dalime Lafkuye Mamona, that have the power to extract the money. Meaning that the only way that a Puzbol works is after you're moser it to people who have the power to extract money. Or the ones who can make the collection on your behalf. Aval Lekulei Amalo, but not all Beti Dinim. That is one of the features of Puzbol today, which is very difficult. Which is that the Puzbol, the way that it's written today, it's going over to individuals that don't necessarily have power of collection. And that's why it might be an issue, which is in our Puzbols today, and this is why some of the Rishonim speak about why the Puzbol went by the wayside, is because we don't have Batei Dinim today that can go and collect, that can go and enforce collection. And because of that, the Puzbol is not meaningful, because you hand it over to Beit Din, but Beit Din can't collect on your behalf. So what's the point of handing it over to Beit Din? What does that do at all? So that's why if you look today, the way that the Puzbols are written, the nature of it is that it's given over to, they try to make it the Rav of Rashi, are people who have stature or power, who have the ability to, quote unquote, collect because of their stature. That means if the Rav of Rashi shows up at your house and tells you to pay, then maybe these people would be paying, or maybe it has more power than simply holding it over to three Hejotot or three Rabbanon that are just sitting in the community. They've tried to make the Puzbol stronger and giving it over to people of stature who have some sort of ability of collection. So that's what's being said here, that maybe the Takana of Hillel was only a Takana that was put in place for Batei Dinim that have power of collection. Although the Rabbeinu Tam dispels this idea because he says that Rabbeinu Tam cut up Puzbol. You don't need the most Choshev Beit Din in the door, you just need a Beit Din that is considered to be Choshev. And so therefore, the Rabbeinu Tam dispels some of this idea that only these super Batei Dinim could create Puzbols, but just a Beit Din that's Choshev is sufficient, and therefore there could be multiple types of those Batei Dinim within a generation, as long as they are a Beit Din of a certain amount of stature. So Gemara says, Tashma, Damar Shmuel, Hal Puzbol Ubana Dedainahu. So Gemara says, let's see it from here. So now the Gemara doesn't have any proof here whether it was permanent or not. At first they died out of proof that it wasn't permanent because it was only allowed to be done in these very strong Batei Dinim, which would make it sound that it was only a temporary takana, not a full-fledged takana. Our answer is no, maybe that was the takana. That the takana only applied to bate dinim that have power of collection. Otherwise, it didn't have power. So now we're back to square one, which is, did Hillel make it only for his generation or permanent? So tashma, we're going to learn it from this. Damar shmol hal prusbol ubana de dainohu. That this prusbol, now, the Gemara is going to ask in a second, what does the word uban mean? But generally, the word aluf means that it's an embarrassment, or it's something difficult. Iyasher chayel avtaline. And Shmuel says, if I was strong enough, or I brought together enough force, I would eliminate the prusbol. Avtaline, how can Shmuel eliminate a prusbol? By inbating yachol avatel divrei badin achavero. How can he undermine something that another badin did? Unless he was greater in Chokhmah Minyan, and the assumption here is that Shmuel did not have such a baitin. So if that's the case, what does that show you? That if Shmuel thinks he can unwind Prusbol, that means that it must have only been for Hillel's generation, not a permanent takana. Then Magar says, no. Hachi kamar. Iyasher chayel yoter mi Hillel avtaline. If I'm able to bring together a force that is greater than Hillel, then I would eliminate it. Meaning that if I have a beitin that's godel b'chokhmah minyan, I would unwind what Hillel did because the prusbol is an ubana d'dayne. Rav Nachman who said Talmid of Shmuel says, akimena, I would actually reinforce that which Hillel put in place. Akimenu, why would he have to reinforce it? Hamikayim v'kayi. It's already in place. Hillel instituted it. Why would he have to reinstitute something that's already an institution? Haki Amar, Ema be Milta. He says, I'm going to say something about it, that Avgav delo kotuv kakotuv dami. He says that I would institute that would be the default status of every loan. Similar to the Tnayei Ketubah. That we say that the Tnayim of a Ketubah apply, even if they're not written into Ketubah. That's a Tnay Beitin. It's an institution of Beit Din that even when you write a Ketubah without all the trappings or the obligations that are supposed to be in Ketubah, it's automatically there because it's not Beit Din. And that's what Rav Nachman says here as well. That I would say Prusbol would become an incorporated document in every loan. That automatically, even if you don't write a Prusbol, even if you don't write in the document, it would happen automatically. He says, I would institute that. That Prusbol would become an automatic appendix to every loan, and if they didn't write it, it would be a part of every loan. So Yibailu, Hayubana. This Ubana that Shmuel spoke about, that it's an Ubana Denaina. What is that? Lishna de Chutzpah? Is it a Lashon of Chutzpah? Meaning that it's something that they shouldn't do and that it's out of their league that they're doing something like this? Oh, Lishna de Nichuto. Or is it done Nichuto? Meaning that it was a way to make it easier, pacify the Dayanim. Meaning that, is it something that the Dayanim are doing that is wrong? Meaning that they really shouldn't be taking other people's property or forgiving loans, and that's what they're doing, and that's lashon of chutzpah, that they're doing something that's really not within their power. Mm-hmm. Or is it nichutalu, it makes their lives easier. Meaning that by the fact that either Beit Din is collecting it, or the fact that not everybody has to run to do their collections before Shemitah, for whatever reason, it's making the lives of the Dayanim easier because of the prusbol. So tashma, damar ula, aluva, Kalash zinta bekerev chupata. How much chutzpah is there for a bride who has znut in the middle of her chupah? Like at her wedding, she's having znut. This is referencing Bnei Yisrael at Har Sinai. I'm Rav Mari, Brat Shmuel. Rav Mari, the son of the daughter of Shmuel. He's the grandson of Shmuel. Shmuel is his maternal grandfather. The reason he's named this way and not for his father's name is because of Shmuel's daughters were taken in captivity, and his daughter ended up marrying one of the captives who was not Jewish, who converted later on, but the conception of the child was Shelo Mikdusha, and he was born Mikdusha, and converted, therefore he's named through his mother to his father and not through his father because of this problem. So Mikro, what is the pasuk that says this? Now again, the midrash that is being quoted over here is about the fact that Bnei Israel worshipped the Egel at Har Sinai. So that's like kalak bechupata, that is mezana, that they worshipped Avodah Zorah right at Har Sinai, right after they got the luchot. So my crawl, what is the pasuk? Ad shamelech b'misibo nirdi natan recho. That while the king was still b'misibo, the misiba or the party, or what is otherwise known as a chasno, meaning at a wedding, that he's still at the party near D Natan Recho. The perfume already lost its smell or its flavor. Meaning that even at the wedding, things start to go sour already. That's what the pasuk is saying. And that's the pasuk that's saying, or the midrash, about what Bnei Israel did. They were still at the party, or they were still at the chuppah of Har Sinai, and it's already souring. They worship Avodah Zarah right there. Amarava, adayin chivivutahu gaban. Despite the fact that they did this, Hashem still loves them. Dichtiv natan loktiv hisriach. The way that the pasuk describes the losing of the smell, you would describe it, if something like this happened, you would say that, the way that I expressed it before, is that it turns sour. Turning sour is a very negative term, or it becomes malodorous. Meaning that the perfume no longer smells good, but actually smells bad. That's not what the pasuk says. The pasuk says, Natan Reicho. It stopped smelling good. Not that it smelled bad. And from that you see, despite the fact that things went bad, or went awry at Har Sinai, despite that fact, Hashem still loves us, meaning that it only took away the good smell, it didn't become something rotten. And for that reason, we know that Hashem forgave us, or that the relationship is still intact. Now, Tan Rabbanan, Hane Elavim Beinan Ovim. These are people who are affronted, or people speak disparagingly about them, Beinan Ovim, but they do not return fire. Now, these are people who are denigrated, and do not denigrate others. These are people who, people speak to them inappropriately, and they do not respond. Shom'im Cherpatam Beinan Mishivim. They hear things that are embarrassing. They hear terms that denigrate them or put them down. They do not respond. They do things out of love, and they love isurim. Aleihem ha-katuv omer. About these individuals, the pasuk says, Vo'ovav k'tzeit ha-shemesh b'gruato. Those that are beloved to Hashem are like when the sun comes out in its full force. So here the Gemara proves from this, the word aliva or aloof means chutzpah, or to denigrate or to put down. Similar to the way we saw that before. Hayubana lushna de chutzpah. Here again you have the word aluva being used in the same way. Ne'alavim or aluva is used as to denigrate or to have chutzpah. And that's the same thing over here with regards to what Shmuel is saying, that it's a chutzpah for Beit Din to exercise their right to change ownership of loans, and therefore it's really outside of what they should be empowered to do. And that's the problem over here. That's a small thing. It's too much power vested in the Beit Din, and he would unwind the Prus Bowl because they shouldn't be doing this. And that's what the term Nelavim means. Obviously this Musar here is tremendous about the way that one should conduct themselves. Hashem loves people who, when people put them down and people do bad things to them, instead of responding in kind, and someone speaks Lashon Hara, speaking Lashon Hara back, instead of people, when they speak disparagingly about you, you don't speak back bad at them, you don't go back at them. That's what Hashem says over here. These are people who are beloved. These are people who don't worry about what other people say, are not affected by what other people say, and they're able to conduct themselves and not have to put other people down in order to even the score. These are people that Hashem loves. These are the people that Hashem really cares about, that they worship Hashem, me'ava, out of love. They're not looking for schar, they're not looking for irat, they're not worried about puranot, they do it out of love. These are tremendous people, and these are tremendous musar about how we must conduct ourselves, or who Hashem really cares about. What type of people? It's not people who go trample over other people, it's the people that get trampled that Hashem really loves. My pruzbol. What is the meaning of this word pruzbol? Pruzbol is clearly not a Hebrew word, right, but it seems to be some sort of Greek word, and here the Gemara says, Amar Rav Chista, prus, buli, ubuti. So prus, Rashi says, comes the word prus, or takana. It's a decree or an institution of the buli, ubuti. What are the buli, ubuti? Buli, elu, ashirim. Buli are the wealthy ones, dichtiv. Vishabarti, et go'onuschem. Hashem says, with regards to when we do bad, and we're going to be put into galut, it says, shabarti, et go'onuschem. I'm going to break down your greatness or your haughtiness. But Tani Rav Yosef says, Elu bol'ot sh'b'Yehuda. Those are the wealthy individuals. Those are the aristocracy of Yehuda. So you see the word term bol or bol'ot means the wealthy individuals. So it's a prus, a takanar decree for the bully, the rich ones. Buti elu ayinim. Buti means for the poor people. Dichtiv. Havet tavitenu. Avot is a mashkom, and it says,
Who is the person, as Rashi says over here?
When you lend money, who are the people who are borrowing money? The aniim, the poor people.
So you see the word avot, or the word buti, refers to the poor people.
So it's an institution for the rich and for the poor.
Why?
For the rich people, so that they will lend the money and they will get repaid. For the poor people, so that there's liquidity in the market and they can borrow money, because the rich people are willing to lend because their loans are not going to be forgiven. So the Prus Ball was a way to help both those that were lending as well as those that are borrowing. The rich who are lending and the poor who are borrowing. And that's what the Prus Ball is, a contraction of these three terms. Amle Rava Loaza. Rava says to Loaza, Loaza is someone who speaks a foreign language, does not speak Hebrew. So someone who speaks, that's where Rashi calls Bilaz, when he wants to give the old French word for something that he's trying to translate. Or Loazi, or Loaz is a foreign language, Lashon, maybe Avodah Zarah, but, or Lashon of some foreigner. My Prusbol. What is the meaning of the Prusbol? Amle, Pursa de Milta. He says that it is Pursa. We saw before, Prusa, Pursa is a decree or a document of sorts. So it's Pursa de Milta means that it is a decree of words, or it's a decree of something that is helpful. It was a takana that rectified a situation, or a takana of something significant. So basically, it's a way to fix or rectify a situation that had become problematic. And that's exactly what the Prus Ball does. It rectifies this problem that people have stopped lending money. And so that's what the word Prus Ball, or the conjugation of the word Prus Ball, means over here. And we're going to stop here, five lines down on the top of Lamed Zayin Amud Aleph.